The forum can think of no better person to institute the first annual Rappaport lecture than our guest, Mayor Koch. Now, to introduce you to our main guest, we have Professor Lance Liebman of Harvard Law School.
I was given the great honor of introducing Mayor Koch because once, a very long time ago, I held a minor position on the staff of one of his predecessors, Mayor Lindsay. I could tell you at length about my mistakes, frustrations, and failures working in City Hall in New York, but Mayor Koch usually talks about his successes, so I will tell you that I had one success. One day during Lindsay's 1969 re-election campaign, I was in charge of a photo opportunity, a visit by the mayor to a new air-conditioned subway train. With the TV cameras running, the mayor went down into a station to see the new train. Many functionaries of the Transit Authority were guiding the mayor, and they were holding open an exit gate so he could walk straight to the platform. In an unplanned moment of genius, it occurred to me to reach into my pocket, grab a token, give it to the mayor, and point him to the turnstile. All the local news shows that night made a point of showing that he had paid just like an average strap hanger. For 24 hours, I was a hero in City Hall. I was an amateur at politics of that sort. Mayor Koch has for 30 years been a professional. He has symbolized the citizen of New York City, in New York City and around the world. He has proved that while a mayor manages large bureaucracies, his main function is to speak to and on behalf of those who are his constituents. He is a brilliant urban leader, and his talents have been crucial in the survival and the resurrection of a wonderful and important city. Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Professor, for that very generous introduction. I want to say to Mrs. Rappaport and to the members of the faculty how honored I am that you would choose me as your first speaker. And the subject that I've taken is that relating to juvenile criminality. And I think it's a matter of extreme importance because I do not believe that we are addressing the issue appropriately. I want to make some formal remarks on the subject and then to take your Q&A on any subject that you believe appropriate. But this is a matter of concern not only for New York but for every urban and suburban and indeed even rural jurisdictions. Probably you've all heard someone start a speech about juvenile crime with a quote about young people being wild and disobedient and disrespectful, constantly breaking the law and violating social mores. And the source of the quote is invariably some ancient sage who is prophesying the imminent collapse of civilization. And the quote is supposed to show that in spite of thousands of years of those complaints, civilization hasn't collapsed, and that adults always overreact to high-spirited adolescents, that our modern-day problem isn't really all that serious. Well, I don't believe in such attempts to sentimentalize the youthful, predatory, and violent behavior, which is endemic in our society, and of a scope which may be unprecedented for sheer impact upon public safety. You've probably heard that juvenile criminality is caused by poor parents, poor schools, poor housing, poor neighbors, poor race relations, and poorness in general. I don't believe that either. The vast majority of citizens who are poor or uneducated do not steal, do not assault, and do not destroy. They reject, as I do, this elitist and insulting explanation of the cause of crime. Western civilization may not be collapsing, but we must take seriously young people who are given to violence and to cruelty. And I'm not speaking about youngsters who chew gum in class or talk back to their elders. For the most part, juveniles engaged in felonious conduct don't grow out of it. Their disruptive behavior, disruptive juveniles grow into delinquent adolescents, and delinquent adolescents grow into criminal adults. That knowledge should be the basis of our juvenile criminal justice planning. And it's time to rethink our attitudes about juvenile criminals. We have to retool our procedures to deal with the problem effectively. We need better ways to accurately identify juvenile criminals as individuals and as a class. We need realistic crime and age categories for juvenile criminals, and we need the ability to effectively arrest, to detain, and prosecute and punish juveniles. It's important to note that a relatively small number of people commit an overwhelming majority of all crimes in both the juvenile and adult populations. A recent study of criminal records in Philadelphia reveals the connection between chronic juvenile offenders and their evolution into adult career criminals. Of persons born in 1958 who lived in Philadelphia from 1968 to 1975, only 7% of the youths were identified as chronically delinquent, but they accounted for 75% of all serious crime in their age group. Let me repeat that. 7% of the youth accounted for 75% of the serious crime. The core 7% or so of the population which is actively and persistently criminal is a figure that is fairly universal and which has remained stable over so many years. But today, this core criminal fraction is committing more crime and more serious crime. The core criminal group is composed primarily of young males who are demonstrably and unusually aggressive and impulsive and who lack socialization. They also have lower than average intelligence. Now, criminals may be less capable than most people of analyzing and understanding and recognizing what is right and what is right, appropriate, and non-criminal behavior. But, and this is important, would-be criminals can learn what is appropriate. They can learn, but if and only if values and appropriate standards of behavior are clearly, consistently, and constantly taught, and only if deviations from appropriate behavior are clearly, consistently, and constantly punished. I think punishment does deter crime. And the more certain the punishment and the certainty of its imposition, the better it works. And I will tell you why. It works because most people prefer pleasant consequences to the unpleasant. And most of us have fairly standard conceptions of what is pleasant and what is unpleasant. Jail is not broadly perceived as a pleasant experience. And we can be certain that not punishing improper behavior has no deterrent effect. Paul Tracy, one of the authors of the Philadelphia study, makes the not so surprising to me statement that, I quote, if you let a kid do what he does with impunity, then he's going to continue to do it. I don't know why people think punishment doesn't work. It clearly does. In a sentencing report, a probation officer asked a 15-year-old why he stepped up the pace of a string of robberies when he turned 15. His answer was quite simple. It wasn't poverty. It wasn't lack of education. He had escalated the rate of his robbery activities because the crimes, as he put it, were free. He wouldn't be punished for committing crimes before he was 16. And he had to plan for his future. How much clearer a demonstration do we need that criminals, even juveniles, understand and are deterred by punishment or the threat of it? This young man was not unusually clever. The same sentiment that crime before 16 is free is frequently expressed by juvenile criminals. It doesn't take a lot of intelligence to figure that out. Why do so many intelligent people refuse to believe it? So, what do we need to better handle our juvenile crime problem? To help solve the problem, I'm supporting several proposals which are before the New York State Legislature this year. States which have similar problems might do well to consider similar solutions. To begin with, we have almost made it impossible to even identify juveniles charged with crimes, let alone connect them with other criminal conduct in which they may have engaged. Thanks to some well-intentioned but misguided efforts to avoid stigmatizing a young person for life with a police record, we don't fingerprint most juvenile criminals charged with felonies. But without fingerprints, we cannot definitely identify people, especially young people, or accurately determine their ages, an important part of our juvenile justice procedure. I'm not talking about identifying kids who set off firecrackers in the alley or put soap powder in a public fountain. Almost half of the juveniles arrested in New York City in 1985 were charged with Class D and Class E felonies, which are robberies, sodomies, and sexual abuse, and burglaries, and arsons, and assaults, and the possession of weapons. These crimes are not fingerprintable under current law. In 1984, some 2,100 serious juvenile felony cases were processed in this city in which we couldn't even confirm the identities of the juveniles involved. How can we expect a young person to respect a system where he's interviewed by a probation officer who recognizes him from the last time, or the last three times, or the last 10 times that he was brought in, but can't figure out what his real name is and who has no capacity to do so? How can we run a system like that? I think we should fingerprint any person age 13 or older who is charged with any felony. Also, we should require the appropriate authorities to maintain any juvenile delinquent adjudication of any fingerprinted person and preserve for adult records any juvenile conviction record for a Class A, B, or C felony or for any two felonies. Then we need to allow access to these records, in proper circumstances, of course, to the family court probation officers, and to the prosecutors, and to defense counsel, and to the judges. It doesn't come as a revelation to me that probation officers need to know whether and how a particular juvenile's prior cases have been disposed of. Only in this way are they to be able to make a disposition recommendation which will best serve the interests of the community and the delinquent. In recommending a disposition in a juvenile case, a probation officer should be able, and in New York State is required by our prior offender provisions, to consider whether this is the first time or the 10th time that we've seen this person. We should consider what past programs or punishments have accomplished, if anything. That certainly makes just common sense, but probation officers now can't even look back into the probation's own files, let alone consult comprehensive files organized in an accessible fashion. Legislation plainly exempting internal agencies of the criminal justice system from general sealing requirements controlling juvenile records is imperative. Keeping usable records will, for the first time, make it possible to deal with juveniles on a consistent and progressive basis. Ridiculous as it seems, we've never tried knowledge and consistency as a way to improve our juvenile justice program. There is also no reason for juvenile delinquency proceedings to be conducted in secret. They should be open to the public and the press, which will serve the dual purposes of revealing inadequate family court procedures and dispositions and exposing the juvenile delinquent to public accountability for his actions. Accountability is one of the most basic elements of dealing with misconduct on any level. And after we establish a mechanism to identify our juvenile criminal population, we have to be able, when it is necessary and appropriate, to treat juveniles with charges and in age categories which reflect the seriousness of the conduct. We need to expand the categories of so-called designated felonies for which juveniles can be prosecuted to include, among other crimes, residential burglaries and all attempts to commit designated felonies. And we must also restrict family court judges' unfettered discretion, which they now have in even very serious felonies, and the law allows them to adjourn matters in contemplation of dismissal, to, as we refer to it in New York, ACD, the case over the objection of the prosecutor. Juvenile criminal cases must be treated with appropriate seriousness at all levels of the system. In New York, juveniles who are adjudicated delinquents and sentenced to confinement in facilities of the State Division for Youth can be released as soon as they arrive without notice to anyone. The director can release them to their home. Public safety requires that prosecutors should have notice and should have an opportunity to be heard when dangerous juveniles are released before they have spent at least two-thirds of their placement time in a residential facility. All of these recommendations have a common thread. In an overwhelming percentage of cases, adults and juveniles commit crimes because the rewards of criminal conduct are sufficiently great and the likelihood of being caught or held responsible is sufficiently remote. Crime then becomes attractive. We don't have sufficient resources to catch and to punish all, or even most criminals. National law enforcement authorities agree that the great majority of serious crimes in this country go unpunished. We must punish the criminals when we are so fortunate as to catch them. Juvenile criminals are willful, selfish, and irresponsible individuals, and experience shows us they will grow up to be willful, selfish, and irresponsible adults unless we persuade them that there are real penalties for such conduct. And when we deter young people from committing juvenile crime, we have a chance of deterring them from adult crime, a chance of saving them from a lifetime of pain for themselves and their society. Just to conclude the formal remarks, and then we'll go to Q&A. If you ask people, what is it that they want out of life? It is to be secure in their homes, the streets that they walk, the subways that they ride. And it is knowing that there was a time when people did feel secure. And then there was this escalation. And all the time, the protection seemed not to be for society, but rather for the person charged with criminality. Now, there has to be a balancing of interests. It cannot be that our only concern is for the defendant and the person charged with criminality. Our overriding concern has to be for the protection of society. The balance is out of whack, and I believe must be restored. I'll stop. I'll take your questions. Who's got the first question? Sir.
Mr. Mayor, I hope...
You have a mic there. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I hope you'll forgive me if I ask a question on a different topic.
No, we said it from the very beginning. You can ask anything on anything.
Okay. I want to ask you about the corruption scandal in New York. You've been introducing over the last few weeks an impressive list of reforms to deal with the way that the city dishes out contracts and political appointments. And I have full faith that the investigators will gradually nail down all the individuals and figure out who was paying off whom and at whose direction. But I want to ask you, what is wrong in the system that allowed us to get to this point, in a broader sense, that such a widespread, or apparently widespread, scandal could develop under our very noses?
Okay, it's a fair question, and let me just take a couple of minutes to respond. As of this moment, one person has been arrested. Are you aware of that? I suspect that there will be more people, and we know that the borough president of Queens has stepped down, and there's no question in my mind that he's implicated in that, and it'll be the criminal court processes that will pursue that matter with him. Now you have to ask, as you have, why is it that we didn't know about this particular item of corruption? That corruption exists in a city? You think it exists in Philadelphia? Boston, L.A., Chicago? Of course. Do you know that in the... Because you know why it exists? Because the people who work in a city government come from society. And Boston has less than 600,000 people living in the city, I'm told. there are 300,000 people working in the city government of New York. More than half the population of the city of Boston, the number, represents our employees. Now, obviously, they're going to be corrupt people. They come from a society that has corruption in it. Now, as it relates to the catching of this particular corruption, it was not caught in New York. It was caught on a telephone tape in Chicago, where law enforcement authorities had been given information about Chicago corruption in government, and listening to a taped conversation, heard about a corrupt act in New York, and gave the information to the law enforcement authorities in New York. Normally, when you find corruption, and we have arrested and sent to jail, or sought to send to jail, and sometimes judges would simply give fines or weekends in jail, which is a fact. In some cases, it's regrettable, but a fact. Hundreds of people have been sent to jail. This was not found. I'm sorry about that. I hope that they root it out and find everyone involved in it, and they send them to jail. But why should it shock you that there would be corruption in any city in America, including New York City? Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Mayor, we're not talking about the 300,000th city employee. We're not talking about a brownie who fixes parking tickets. We're talking about what appears to be a widespread system of corruption among the highest officials in the city
that's
government.
Well, no, you see, you have to be careful about that. One person has been arrested, is that right?
One so far.
That's right. Okay. I mean, this has been going on now for weeks, is that right? We know one person has been arrested and one person has been identified as being involved, the borough president, and the involvement will have to be established through the criminal court process. I am not defending it even if it's one. I am simply saying that there has never been a city or an administration that did not have within it people who were corrupt, not intentionally, whether it's my three immediate predecessors or the mayor of mayors, Fiore LaGuardia. So I'm not defensive about it, but I accept responsibility and fault. I want you to understand that. Anything that takes place in the city of New York that's good, I take credit for it if it happened in my administration. And if it is bad, I accept blame. And then the question is, what do you do about it? Well, you do what's reasonable, what's common sense. And I'm going to use your question to just extend this, because I think it's probably interesting to most people, because it's on the front pages. Right. You know, when the matter came to public attention as it related to the borough president, it was a shock to me. He's independently elected by the people in Queens, highest office, a friend of mine for at least 20 years, maybe more. And it was a shock to me. And I said it was horrible. And I gave vent to my anger, and I labeled him for what he is. Because it might offend the reporters. I say for a moment that I believe that public officials are held to a higher standard than whether they've been indicted or arrested. And so I hold my fellow public officials, as I do myself, to a higher standard. I was shocked, frankly, that there were people who attacked me for labeling Mr. Manis what he is. Someone who violated his public oath of office and engaged in criminality. And I wondered why it was that they were so ferocious in their comments as they related to me and my comments. I don't really know. Some undoubtedly possessed with this overbalancing of interest, somewhat along the lines of defending the criminal as opposed to society that I referred to in my speech. Others, I think, somewhat hypocritical. This is not an attack on the press, not intended that way, but it's just interesting since this is a classroom. This is a classroom. A reporter said to me on a television show, "Don't you realize the pain that you caused that family by your labeling the husband, your friend, with this terrible word?" I'll tell you the word at the end. And I said to this reporter, I was trying to be kind, I wanted to say, did not, "What kind of a hypocritical statement is this? Are you aware of all of the reporters who stand in front of his house, who stood in front of the hospital and badgered his kids and his wife and put mics in his face when he went to the doctor? And you're telling me that in my capacity as mayor of this city, I'm not allowed to label a crook a crook?" I was aghast, but I said very little. Now, what is it that we're seeking to do to root out corruption? I appointed a former U.S. attorney, John Martin, to root it out, to tell us what practices have to be changed. We're cooperating with the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney and John Martin and the district attorney said to me, "It would be helpful if you gave what is in effect civil immunity to people who come forward and say they were involved in the corruption, if they help us to establish corruption on the part of others." And I said, "It goes against my grain to give immunity to a corrupt person. But if you believe it's helpful to your investigation, we will do it." The civil aspect of allowing them to continue with their contracts, providing that they deliver service without corruption. So I think that, of course I'm embarrassed. Of course I'm embarrassed. I mean, it's horrible. Horrible. And I thought to myself when the matter was raised on a couple of occasions, I thought to myself, what's the public think? And one of the newspapers, one of the dailies, Daily News, great newspaper in the city of New York, well, it's the largest circulation in the, maybe the country, I don't know, in the country. So let's not forget that. They did a poll. And they did a poll, and the poll results were quite interesting. The poll results were the following. They said to them, "What do you think of politicians, public officials?" And 42% said, "Most of them are corrupt." "What do you think of Ed Koch?" 79% said, "He's honest." In Queens, 88%. I can't quite understand that. 71% said the mayor is doing a good job. Two-thirds said, in response to the question, "Well, if they show corruption in the Parking Violations Bureau, do you hold the mayor responsible?" And they said, "No. I hold myself responsible even if they don't." Okay? Next. Sorry.
Mayor Koch, my question concerns the Guy McGivern case. I was wondering, first, do you agree with Governor Cuomo's decision to grant clemency? And second of all, how do you account for Vice President Bush's comments recently at a conservative dinner when he said that as Governor Ronald Reagan didn't set cop killers free?
I happen to believe that the governor should not have provided for, what's it, it's... reduction in sentence. He did not give him a pardon, but a reduction in sentence that would make him eligible at an earlier time for a pardon. But that is a decision which is a very difficult one for governors. They're given the power to pardon. They're given the power to commute. They're given the power to reduce sentences. And it's a tough decision. I can disagree with the governor without finding him at fault. You can understand the difference. There are lots of issues, for example, very controversial issues that people can be moral on both sides of the issue. The death penalty, gay rights, school busing, a whole host of racial quotas. Those are gut issues. And you can be moral on any side of those issues and respect the other person's position, even if you disagree with them. So I respect the governor's position. I happen to have disagreed with it. As it relates to President Bush, let me just tell you this. I doubt that he will ever be president, if you want the God's honest truth. And I must say that I believe he hurt himself with his comments in that area and on ethnics. I believe that in his own party, and they have said to me, a number of people, leaders in his own party, who believe that he committed a terrible, terrible error for his own career. Okay? Next. Please.
Hi. I noticed that you admitted race from your description of young criminals. I've learned in criminal law, and I've learned from experience living in New York, that most young criminals are blacks and Hispanics, members of minority groups. Does that mean that we are inherently more violent, vicious, and irresponsible than white youth? Or is it possible, is it at all possible, that bad economic and social conditions are somehow linked to crime?
The answer is that the black community is only 12% of the country, and there are huge areas where there are no blacks or very few blacks.
Fine.
And in those areas where there are a few blacks or no blacks, the same statistics would apply to the people who are almost all white.
Okay.
Okay?
As I said, I mentioned economics, but in New York specifically, would you say that that applies to New York?
I do not believe that race or economics is relevant to criminality.
Well, I don't believe that it is relevant. Race is relevant necessarily, but the facts show, the statistics show, that most young criminals are blacks or Hispanics, and they also show that most blacks and Hispanics live in poverty in this country.
I want to again say to you that if you go to areas where they are not black and Hispanic, you will find similar statistics amongst whites.
Okay.
I'll give you the best statistic of all. In the height of the Depression, in the 30s, much less crime than today, where more people are affluent. More people were suffering in the 30s than are suffering today. Take my word for it. And there were fewer criminals.
I think you failed to see my point, though.
Well, I've tried to,
I'm simply saying that it is not
poverty.
Yes. Well, it doesn't, I think it's linked in some ways, and I also think that you're failing to see what I'm telling you. The statistics show, the statistics show that most criminals, the majority of young criminals, the majority of crime committed before the age of 19 are committed by blacks or Hispanics.
And I'm going to say that most blacks, most Hispanics, most poor people are honest citizens.
I would be
and the
first
people
to agree with you
who are ripped off. Most are blacks and Hispanics who are honest citizens by other people. I disagree with you, respectfully, that either poverty or race or ethnicity is related to the criminality.
I think poverty is. Well, however, I'll be the first one to agree with you that most blacks and Hispanics and most poor people are hardworking and decent people.
You bet.
I'm one of them.
You bet. Next.
What do you think is better about the New York of today than the New York of 30 years ago? Besides the mayor.
You saved me from an arrogant statement. I believe that every age, era, is the best. The one that you are living in. I recall when I was first elected in the summer of 1978, I went to Coney Island to walk on the boardwalk. And an elderly lady, she must have been in her late 70s, came rushing as rush she could towards me. And she grabbed my hand and she said, "Mayor, Mayor, make it like it was." And I thought to myself at the time, it never was the way you think it was, but I will try to make it better. These are the most exciting times with all of our problems. And therefore, I would never want to be Back to the Future in any movie or real life, or Spirited to the Future Ahead, other than in a natural chronological way. That's the best answer I can give you. New York today is an exciting city, more exciting than it ever was. There is a renaissance and a resurgence and a feeling that's different than 30 years ago, but the people who lived 30 years ago undoubtedly felt something similar. Sir.
To get back to one of the earlier questions, I was wondering whether, in light of your willingness to accept responsibility for the goings-on at the Parkings Violation Bureau, whether you're now prepared to support legislation which would prevent political party leaders such as Mr. Manis or Stanley Friedman from participating in businesses that do business with the city, and also whether you're willing to support legislation which would put a cap on political contributions to candidates for public office in New York.
Yes. Do they have the New York Times up here? It's in today's New York Times.
No, I don't recall the Times article saying that you were going to support
today
the suggestions of the Corporation Council.
Yeah, the Corporation Council prepared that at my request. The caps on political financing of $2,000 was taken from a speech that, or I should say an op-ed article that I wrote last November. Whole host of things that he is proposing, he and I have discussed together. I'm supporting every one of them, including the two you mentioned. It's set forth in detail in the New York Times today.
Would you also support, beyond just the $2,000 cap, the barring of any contributions from business people who have contracts with the city to people running for borough president or...
It makes no sense because it's impossible to know who does business with the city and at what point you say they're not doing business with the city. The city buys well over $1 billion in goods and services in the course of a year. There are very few people who don't have some application with the city. Now, you can say, well, it has to be at this level as opposed to this level, then it becomes a question. I don't believe that's the answer, frankly. I believe there are two safeguards. One is that you limit the contribution so that, unlike today, whereas someone in a citywide race for mayor can make a contribution of up to $50,000 in any one election, we are proposing that it be capped at $2,000. Also, there already is required that whatever contribution you make be made public. I believe the publication and the limitation is adequate to deal with that particular problem. Okay? Next, sir.
A few questions, Mr. Mayor. Do you think that the turn of events in the Getz case is going to encourage vigilantism? And what result would you have preferred to have seen in that? And also, could you tell us a few of your favorite Chinese restaurants in the city?
Yes, I'll do that. Let's see. So first is vigilantism, the second is what I would have favored, and the third is Chinese restaurants. Okay. Okay. Let me spell out for you what the Getz case had and currently has as its history, and then make some comments as what I believe its effect to be. A report is made that a person on a subway car shoots four young men and leaves the car and runs down a subway tunnel. It's reported in the press. My comment is asked for, and I say we will not tolerate vigilantism in New York City. That is the way that sounded. The incident. The next day, I said, the person who committed this incident action should come back and tell us what happened, because only he can tell us whether he was a victim or a villain. And he came back not because of me, but because they caught him up there. And he was taken to a grand jury. And his taped confession, made, I think, in Vermont, was made public. And as he explained the incident, the grand jury apparently believed him and said that he was acting in self-defense and that they would not indict him for that matter, but would indict him for having possession of an illegal gun. The press often comes to ask me of me my opinion. My opinion, that I thought what the grand jury did was appropriate, that I was pleased that they had indicted him for illegal possession of a gun, because it's my position that anyone who has an illegal gun should go to jail for a minimum of 1 year. If the governor wants to pardon, he can pardon. If the grand jury believes that there are facts which bear upon it that they don't want to indict, another story. But I don't believe there should be any ifs, ands, or buts. If you're in possession of an illegal gun and you're convicted, you should go to jail for a year. That's my belief, and that'll have a great deterrent in to people carrying guns illegally in our city. Then the district attorney, Robert Morgenthau, said he had additional evidence of another witness not produced at the first grand jury. Happened to be one of the young men. The second grand jury indicted. Press asked me my opinion. I said they believe that there was sufficient evidence as a result of a witness. I have no alternative opinion. I don't have any adverse comment on it. A year goes by, approximately, and several of the young men make statements bearing upon what they intended to do to Getz. What's that? Oh, she's right. She's one of the reporters who asked me my opinion. And I thank you for that. After he was exonerated by the grand jury, no bill brought in on the first at the first grand jury, he then made a statement which was that the city of New York should arm 25,000 citizens. I was asked for my opinion. I said, this guy is flaky. Bob Morgenthau brought in the second grand jury because of a new witness. The second grand jury indicted for the shootings, and then over the course of the year the case dragged out, there were some admissions, and the defense counsel brought a motion before the court contesting the second grand jury's indictment, and the court agreed with the defense counsel and dismissed the indictment on the shooting with leave to appeal to a higher court or to apply to another judge for permission to go to a third grand jury. Now, that's chronologically what happened. I have no opinion at this time as it relates to what the appeals court should do with respect to the dismissal of the indictment or shooting. I don't know. That's Bob Morgenthau thinks that there's adequate evidence. He's one of the great law enforcers, prosecutors. So I'm going to leave that to the court. I don't think asking... New York City, too, because out of the
I have two questions. The first one, this being a Rappaport lecture about urban affairs, the issue of the homeless seems to be appropriate, and it seems like it's a problem that's major in New York and just growing, and it seems like the strategy to do anything about it is a pretty poor one. So I wonder what the strategy will be. The second question is, who do you think should be handling the case against the five families, Morgenthau or Giuliani? I know that they're kind of fighting about it.
Against the?
The mafia. The problem is
I don't think they're fighting about it. I haven't heard that they're fighting about organized crime.
What I've heard is that there has been bickering going on between the district attorney's office and the U.S. attorney's office, and that's hurting the...
Okay, well, I think you got two cases confused. I don't think it relates to organized crime. I think it relates to the current investigation of PVB. I think that's what it is, and that's the one I'll respond to because that's the one I think has been in the papers again. In the papers today. But let me take your two questions. New York City doesn't have the largest number of homeless at all, even with its size. I don't believe we do. I do believe we provide for the largest number, but other cities don't provide. Very few cities have municipal facilities that provide temporary shelter for those who need it. And I'll tell you what the City of New York is doing. City of New York, probably last night, although I didn't call in to get the exact number, probably last night, 9,000 men and women, 15% of them women, were given temporary shelter in a dormitory with beds on a gym floor in some arsenal or some other large facility. We provide those people with three meals a day, a bed with a blanket, sheets, three meals, I said to you, medical care, a sanitation facility, shower, and a recreation room, and they never have to leave the building. And I'm told that in many of these facilities, one-third of the population never leaves the building. We don't require that they do. Now, nobody's ever turned away. And there are complaints by the advocates that we don't provide enough space, that it is dangerous. Frankly, it's far less dangerous than the streets, and I don't believe dangerous to any greater degree than any other comparable facility, hotel that used to be on the Bowery, that we used to call flop houses. I don't think it's any more dangerous than they were, and I don't think that they were particularly dangerous. Occasionally, you're going to get a criminal committing a crime, or a demented person committing a crime, but that happens to the whole city as a result of there being criminals and demented people. You know that, and I know that, as well as other cities outside of New York. Now, with families, we provide shelter in 55 hotels and 5 congregate shelters for about 4,000 families, or roughly 16,000 people, every night. And I suppose many of you must have seen the show 60 Minutes, and it's probably what triggers your question. Anybody else see that show? Good. Let me then just make a brief comment about it. You heard, but nobody listened, to Ed Bradley say, the federal government does not allow localities to use the money that they provide for temporary shelter for permanent shelter. Remember hearing that? You don't remember hearing that. But it was there. I heard it. but I'm one of the few people who understood it, because it means that you can't take the money for permanent shelter. And you heard him say, we're paying a lot of money for hotel space, and we don't like paying for it, but we are lucky when hotels rent to us. We think we're lucky. Even though they make a lot of money, they also have a lot of damage. And not every hotel will rent to us. But the average rental is $15 a night per person. Now, we're in a room, that's $60 a night for the room, on the average. Do you know many hotels, four in a room, where you could go for $15 in any city? I don't know of any. If you multiply that $60 by 7 days, it's $420. And if you multiply that by 4 weeks, it's over $1,600. And that is how you get to these huge, obscene rentals. We have no alternative, although we try. So in the last 2.5 years, for example, we built 6,000 permanent apartments, specially and only for those who are in these circumstances. And we started 2.5 years ago with 2,200 families. We took 6,000 families out of that setting, put them into permanent apartments, and I told you last night we had over 4,000 families. It is a very difficult matter for us, and it will not be addressed in a way where people can look forward to permanent housing in a reasonable time frame until the federal government gets back into the business of building low-income housing. It's as simple as that. Now, in that program, you may remember that suddenly on the screen flashed this young, handsome congressman. You don't remember me? 15 years ago. Remember? Everybody remember? I looked terrific. And there I was, denouncing the mayor for doing what I was doing. And said Mr. Bradley, although he didn't tell me he was going to use that, he didn't at the time, but there's nothing wrong with that, that's okay. He said, he said to me, didn't you denounce Mayor Lindsay? And I said, sure. I didn't know what I was talking about 15 years ago. And what I said 15 years ago about what the mayor could do was factually incorrect. And that if I had the power, said I would sentence every congressman to be a mayor for 1 year as punishment. Now,
wait, can I just, rather than have you answer the question about a case that, you know, I don't really know anything about, okay, and assuring you that I am not mixing up the two cases, but have heard from at least somebody who...
Okay, but I'm not aware of it, so I can't comment that they are scrapping about it. Okay? I can't. Sir?
I'd just like to know, as the Democratic mayor of New York, what you're doing to find a Democratic opponent for Republican Senator D'Amato, or are you going to support
D'Amato?
Not my
obligation to find an opponent.
Well, I mean, are you interested in organizing Democrats in the state so that Democrats can take back the Senate in 1960?
I'll be right up front with you. I'm certainly going to hope to support a Democratic candidate. I'm not out there looking for one. I'll tell you very directly why. If you're a mayor and you have to deal with other governmental units on which the city's lifeline depends, and Washington is one such lifeline, and if you have two senators, one who is a Democrat, an excellent senator, Pat Moynihan, and one who is a Republican, and who in my judgment is an excellent senator. You may disagree, but I am analyzing excellence on the basis of helping the city. That's what excellence relates to me. You can argue with me as to his foreign policy, you know, the UN. You know, it's the old story of the people who are describing who shall take care of the important things, and one of them says, well, I'll take care of the bank account, you take care of the UN. Now, I have to take care of the bank account in the sense of getting help from Washington. Al D'Amato has been very helpful. And if you think that I'm going to go out there and attack him, and then find that when the city needs help, he'll say, listen, Ed. Well, I'm not going to hurt the city in pursuit of a political point. Doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to support him. He didn't support me for mayor. But it does mean I don't perceive it as my obligation to go out and look for his opponent. Am I clear?
Pretty clear, yeah.
Okay, next. Okay, one more question. Sir.
Mr. Mayor, a few weeks ago I saw on TV a tape of a, I think it was an Arkansas judge sentencing a 15-year-old boy to death for first-degree murder. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were the judge and you could do anything that you could, what would you do? Mm-hmm. And getting back to your lecture today, mm-hmm. Are you proposing a bright line rule as to an age, or are you saying that the jury should be able to take into account a number of factors? In other words, do you just want to lower it to 13?
A jury should always be able, or a judge, or a judge and jury, all of the aspects of a case to determine punishment. There should never be, in those states where you have death penalty, a mandatory death penalty, in fact, that it would be unconstitutional. There are some cases where you have career criminals, and if you have been convicted on prior occasions, if you're found guilty on the third occasion, then, or even on the second occasion, then there are mandatory minimums that judges must provide in the event of conviction. Now, as it relates to juveniles who commit felonies, I believe that they should be subject to felony punishment. I believe that. Now, remember, we're not talking about juvenile delinquency. We're not talking about offenses. We're talking about rape. We're talking about physical assault. I believe that to simply say that is a juvenile offense and not a crime makes no sense if you want to protect a society. That's what and you always can take into consideration the age, and the age which I stated in my speech that this would begin would be the age of 13, where you would be held responsible. The nature of the responsibility, that's for the judge and the jury. They will decide. Maybe they will simply decide that an alternative sentence other than jail is required. But they ought to have the right, which is always reviewable by an appellate court. It's not going to be indiscriminately used. I am simply talking about those who are 15, and I gave you the case of a guy who said he's going to go out and commit crimes because he knows he cannot be punished until he's 16. I gave you that reference. That particular person should be punished, and punished as a felon. Okay, now you asked about the death penalty. I don't believe that anyone should be put to death who is who has not reached his majority. Majority in this country is usually 18 years of age. His majority or her majority. I don't, however, take the position that if you committed a crime before you reached your majority and you are apprehended and sentenced and you are now an adult, defined as having reached your majority, that you shouldn't be subject to the severest punishment because you did it when you were 16 instead of 18. You follow what I've just said? And I believe that in most of those cases, I don't know your particular case, but what I believe the cases are is that an individual who committed a crime when they were under 18, now that they're 18 and having been convicted for that earlier crime, subject to the death penalty, ask that it not be executed because they committed the crime when they were under 18. I don't agree with that contention. Am I clear? Good. Now, let me, can I take this one more? But you're the
Thank
last
you.
One.
Okay, Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Two quick questions.
Sure.
One, in response to an earlier question, you said you couldn't understand the attacks you received by members of the press
right.
or comments you made regarding Mr. Manners. Could it be because a week earlier you called Mr. Manners, or Donnie, I believe, your best friend, and that even if he was with a prostitute, it
right.
wouldn't matter?
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly what I said, and I don't think that has a bearing on it. I'll tell you why. Let me explain to you why. Donald Manus is someone who, with whom I've been friends for more than 20 years. The night that he was found in his car, they called me at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they told me that he was found in his car with his wrist slit and dying. And I rushed to the hospital, and they said he had lost a third of his blood, and it turned out that he lost actually half of his blood, and that he would need a blood transfusion. I said, I'm available. They had enough blood, and so they didn't take any volunteers. I then saw him subsequently, but before I saw him, obviously there was a lot of discussion. And the area that he was found in is an area where prostitutes abound. And so the newspapers, not me, the newspapers said, maybe a hustler.
Okay.
At least that's my recollection, newspapers. If it wasn't the news, I see you shaking your head, one of the newspaper reporters. So it was discussed by cops and others, and it was in the public domain. I said that whether it was a prostitute, a hustler, or there was another rumor that he had sought to commit suicide because his father had committed suicide and there was a suicide history in the family, I said whether it was a hustler or whether he committed an attempt of suicide, so long as it didn't involve, I said this publicly, corruption, which the public will never forget. But either of these other two matters, who cares? We'll forgive him, because he had told a story that he had been kidnapped by two guys who had slugged him and cut his wrist, and nobody believed that story. And so then I went, after he admitted that he had lied, and he said, I attempted suicide for personal reasons. Then I said, that's the toughest thing he had to do. From now on, it's okay, so long as it didn't involve corruption. And I went to see him. And indeed, I hugged him and I told him, you don't have to worry anymore and the worst is over. And then 2 days later, I think it's 2 days later, there is the Daily News and an article by Jimmy Breslin that an attorney has said he paid him $36,000, Donnie Manus,
yes,
and to get contracts, and that Donnie Manus had committed these corrupt acts. There wasn't any, and that this attorney was given immunity, ultimately, by the U.S. attorney. And Donnie Manus didn't deny at any time this story. I believed it was perfectly appropriate for me to call for his immediate resignation, which I did, and to voice my anger as I did by calling him what I did, for the reason that he has harmed the body politic. You have to understand that. 42% of the people in the city of New York believe that most people in public office are corrupt. That's what that poll showed. Thank God 78% or more said that they believe that I'm an honest man. Now, what I'm saying to you is, you have no idea of the impact of what he did on other politicians. And that is why I voiced my comment, which from a, you know, you ought to give it to a law school here at Harvard as to whether or not outside of a courtroom you're allowed to say these things. I think you are. I'm a lawyer. I'm happy to engage in that debate. Okay?
Second question, sir. You said you didn't believe Mr. Bush would ever be elected president.
No.
Who on the Republican side of the aisle do you think could possibly get the number?
Well, who are two good people, even though I wouldn't be voting for them, because correct. I will be voting for the Democratic candidate?
Correct, yes. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. I believe there are two good people in the Republican Party. One is Senator Bob Dole, and the other is Governor Tom Kaine.
Bob Dole.
Democrats, I believe that you have many more good people than in the Republican Party, that you have Mario Cuomo, Senator Sam Nunn from Georgia. He's an extraordinary person, even if I found it difficult to pronounce his name. Gary Hart. Bill Bradley, and Richard Gephardt would be maybe the fourth or fifth person whose names come readily to mind. They're all first rate. I think we have to go. I know the governor, and I like him very much. I don't know what his plans are, and he's certainly a very able man, and if he were a contender, he would fit very nicely into that group. Okay? Thank you all. Yeah. Okay.
Please remember to fill out your surveys at the door. Thank you very much.